You're listening to PodcastJuice.net.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Podcast Juice. This is your host, Michael Dean. Hold on, I'm sorry. I got caught up. This is not Michael Dean. This is Q Storm. I have taken over the building. This is going to be the second episode of the movie HQ. HQ standing for Hill and Q Storm. I don't know how he got top billing, but sometimes it's like that. But last week we had a successful program. We discussed The Godfather, and we decided, hey, let's do this again. Today's topic is going to be our favorite movie villains. Sean, you got some good villains for me today?
I hope so. I think there's going to be one omission that might lose my spot on Podcast Juice, but we'll see. When I explain why, hopefully that'll redeem it.
I certainly hope it's not a certain person that's clad in black.
Let's get into it.
All right. So the first thing I thought we'd do is, I don't know about you, but I had to cheat a little bit and go to Google, like, the 50 greatest villains of all time and make sure I wasn't leaving anyone out of my top three. What we're going to do is we have a top three. Each of us has our top three that we're going to give to you from least to best, 3, 2, 1. But we also have, at least I have, a number of honorable mentions that I think have to be noted. So I had to cheat a little bit and just make sure I wasn't leaving anything off our list. So
full disclosure, why don't we do the same thing.
Okay. So why don't we jump right into it? Let's go through our honorable mentions. We'll do this like the Oscars.
All right.
You know, we'll put the categories that nobody really cares about at the beginning of the show.
Well, let's say this before we get into the list. We could both agree, and you know, we typically disagree, but we could both agree that the better the villain, the better the movie, right?
Oh, no doubt. Okay. I mean, without a good villain, you can't have a good. The protagonist is not very interesting.
All right, there we go. So that's a HQ first. We agree.
So why don't we kick it off, Sean? Why don't you run down your list? I mean, we don't want to take a lot of time on our honorable mentions, but we just want to give credit to these antagonists, as I will call them.
All right, so I'll run them down, and you may want to comment. If you want to comment, go ahead. So one of my honorable mentions is Jack Torrance from The Shining. I don't know if that's a traditional villain, but I that's an honorable mention. Hannibal Lecter, of course, we all know him from Silence of the Lambs. Now, I grouped four villains together because, to me, they're kind of the same. They're mechanical. They're non-human. But we've got the Terminator, Alien, HAL 9000, and Jaws.
All right. Okay. All right.
Got Sergeant Hartman. I'm with that. All right. I got Sergeant Hartman from Full Metal Jacket.
I think you and I looked at the same list on Google.
John Doe, Kevin Spacey from Seven. Hans Landa, from Inglourious Basterds. And one that I love, and I think you probably love him too, and I would do the impression, but I don't want to hurt the viewers' ears. Let's just say Khan is also very, very close.
Oh, damn.
Very close to being in my top three. Very, very close.
Now, let's be clear. You are talking about Khan from Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, right?
I'm talking about Mr. Fantasy Island himself, Ricardo Montalban.
Because if you as much as I like Benedict Cumberbatch, if you had said him, I was going to have to come over there and give you a beatdown.
No Benedict here. So what you got? What you got for honorable mention?
Well, I'm going to steal a couple of yours that I forgot. Because I was going to, when we first talked about putting this together, I did have down HAL 9000. But I forgot about him until you mentioned him. So, all right, let me do the human ones first.
All right.
I'm going with Hans Gruber from Die Hard.
Okay.
Now, this one's a dark horse. I just stumbled across him while I was going through my movie collection. And it's this actor's debut performance, and he knocked it out of the park. Armand Goethe from Schindler's List.
Okay.
That was Ralph Fiennes.
All right.
I have the Terminator down, but I got to go with just the original Terminator. Well, Terminator 2, I'll give, Robert Patrick, that was an actor. I'll give him some credit. That's a whole other story. Yeah. I didn't like Terminator 2 when I first saw it.
Yeah, side note, there's going to be a show about that soon, so.
Yeah, and I'm ready to put on the gloves, too. We can get it popping.
but
we'll I have learned to, yeah, I've learned to appreciate that film. So I'll say the first two Terminators.
Okay.
Now the second two are non-human. I'm going to go with the Xenomorphs from Alien.
All right, I said Alien.
From
yeah.
the Alien series, and I'm going because now this one is another from left field, but they really did change the course of pop culture ever since they appeared on screen in 1993. Can you guess who I'm going to say?
93. No, I'm drawing a blank.
Every little kid probably dressed up as one at some point in Halloween after seeing this movie.
Oh man, I'm still drawing a blank.
Velociraptors.
Ah, Jurassic Park. Oh, how could I forget this?
There you go.
Coming soon, Jurassic World. Actually.
Yeah, that's. I'll go see it, but that's what you call cash grab.
I would agree.
I mean, the reason I had a problem putting them on my list. I mean, I put them on the list because they really did. I mean, no one gave a shit about dinosaurs until Jurassic Park came on screen. But they're really just animals. I hate to think of animals as villains, but you know what's ironic about that is more and more, the thing that's making these movies worse and worse as they go along. Although I did like Jurassic Park 3, I have to say that. They are making the animals more like sentient villains, and they're not.
Right.
You know, so now let me go into the Hall of Fame. We got to talk about Norman Bates.
He almost made my list, but I left him off.
The very first appearance of the serial killer, and then we got to talk about Michael Myers. Yeah.
You know, I left those off too, just because they're not really villains per se. Well, yes, they're villains, but I think they've kind of – they morphed into heroes, I think, actually all of them. You know what I mean? So I left them off. Maybe, you know, if we're talking, you know, Friday the 13th Part 2 maybe or the first Halloween. Yeah, but the more the character evolved or the more the films evolved, the more, you know, people were going to see, Mike Myers, not the actual movie itself. So that was the only reason why I left those slashers off there. But I can see why you left them on there.
All right. So let's get into the main event here.
All right.
Ding ding. We're gonna do our top three villains, and I did not choose these. They weren't easy, but we're gonna start with number three. I'll let you go. Let you take the lead.
Okay. This villain has a penchant for having people kneel. In front of
him. you motherfucker.
he's got the second coolest beard of all the villains out there. That dude they had some barber on Krypton, didn't they? Dude,
he got the Morse chestnut.
Yeah, he was lined up. Good. No, but Zod is number three on my list as far as the best villains of all time. Zod is cold. Zod is also cool. Zod knows what he wants. He doesn't care. There is no redeeming quality about him. They don't try to make him nice. They don't, you know, try to make him have a turning point. Dude is just evil from the first frame until he's thrown down the chasm in the Fortress of Solitude. There's nothing better than General Zod.
Well, I have to say that was my number three as
That's
well.
Your number three.
That was my number three. I mean, now I put Zod as my number three because, as anyone who has listened to this podcast or to Geeked Out, you've heard me say, maybe you've seen on the Facebook page, Superman 2. I saw that when I was, I'm going to say, that came out in 1981, right?
Yes.
So I was, I was 15 or 16, I want to say. And that movie, while it's very difficult to watch today, that movie changed the course of my life in terms of that movie blew my head open. I saw it probably 6 times in the theaters. I saw it, I don't know how many times after when it came out on home video, which was a few years later because I don't think VHS was even around back then, or not widely spread. But I had no idea who Terrence Stamp was before I saw that movie. After I saw that movie, I had to see this man in anything he did. Now, I will say that in retrospect, you know, so many decades later, when I look back at the film, he is rather two-dimensional.
Yeah.
Okay. However, what he does within those two dimensions is just the best thing, one of the best things you're going to see in a villain on screen.
Right.
Now, which draws the comparison. How do you compare Terrence Stamp's Zod to Michael, what's his name?
Shannon.
Michael Shannon's Zod.
They're not even the same character to me. I don't know. I kind of wish they would have gone with a different villain. I mean, I know that, you know, there's limited Kryptonian villains, but I didn't really like the guy. When I say I didn't like him, I didn't care. Like, I liked Zod. I know I'm not supposed to like Zod, but you still like Terrence Stamp Zod. I didn't even care about him. The only part I liked that he did was when he's on Krypton and he yells, he says, "I will find him. I will find him. I will find him." You know, that was like the only thing. I was like, oh, okay, all right. Zod's a little determined, but I guess it says a lot too about the film as well. I was underwhelmed with the film. And then that just making Zod just being even more underwhelmed. Although I don't really, and I've heard other people discuss this, and I'll see what you think on it. Is Zod though really a villain per se in Man of Steel? Because what he's doing is, I guess, quote unquote, noble, but maybe he's going about it the wrong way. I mean, he's trying to, you know, basically save his race, his planet. I know. You know, that involves killing humans, but I mean, is that ultimately a bad thing?
Well, I would say in our own history, back in 1939, there were a group of people who were trying to save their their nationality
all
and
right,
their
I
race.
Gotcha, I got gotcha, you.
All right. By killing a lot of people.
Well, that shuts that argument down.
Yeah. So I'd say, yeah, he's a villain.
All right.
Now, let me go back to Terrence Stamp's Zod. The one thing, what makes him so brilliant is that there's so many quotable lines.
I mean, yes, yeah.
When I think of Michael Shannon's Zod, that line you just said, that's about it.
Yeah.
With Zod from Superman 2, you know, who is this Superman? Come before me if you dare. I defy you. Come and kneel before Zod. I mean, I can quote every line. These humans are beginning to bore me. You know, just such really good, campy, cheesy stuff there.
My favorite, and I use this to this day, my favorite Zod line is, "I win. I always win.
I always win.
Is there anybody on this
is
planet,
there no one
to,
on this planet
challenge
to defy me?
Me?
Defy me? Or, no, challenge
just
me.
Challenge
yes.
me, yeah. Yeah, when I'm playing board games here with the family and I win, I always say that when I win. Is there anyone in this house to even challenge me? So, yes.
But I got to think the best line he utters. Well, there's that moment in the White House where he says, "You are not the president. No one who leads so many would kneel so quickly."
Yeah.
And then the president goes into his thing and he says, he kneels down and he says, "Oh, God." And my man says, "Zod." So yeah, now having said all that, and there's so many I could go on quoting his lines,
yeah.
But the one thing I'd say Michael Shannon Zod had over him was that he had a purpose other than wanting to rule.
Right.
I'm not going to say that makes him better, but it makes him a little bit more relatable.
Yeah, he wanted vengeance. I mean, that's everyone.
I'm talking about. He wanted vengeance after the what was that thing called, the Codex or whatever it was called?
Yeah,
that was implanted in the Superman was destroyed.
Yeah.
But before that, he like you said, he wanted Krypton was gone and dead, but he saw an opportunity to revive his people. Now, like you say, he went about it the wrong way, but he had a motivation other than wanting to rule.
Yeah.
And we don't even know if he wanted to rule the new Kryptonians that he was going to supplant. Yeah, he was going to plant on Earth.
Never really was clear on that.
So he was more, you know, 21st century. He wasn't just the comic book villain, but I got to tell you, Zod from Superman 2 rules over him only because I can quote every line. I remember everything that guy did in that film. And so he wins the day in terms of who played Zod best.
Oh, without a doubt. No doubt. All right. You ready for my number two? All right.
Ready for number two.
All right. This villain is a fairly new villain in cinema. He's only had one screen appearance. I don't think there's going to be another. Go ahead.
Now, before you say who it is, I want to take a guess at it.
Well, that's what I'm going to do. He has one of the worst haircuts in the
Okay. You gave it away right there.
And he has a penchant for flipping, for coin flipping.
Oh, wait. All right. Let me have. Okay. You said worst haircut and you said recent appearance.
Yeah. He's a newer villain.
He's only appeared one time, right?
In one movie. It's a standalone movie. Right. It's not like a series or anything like that. He likes coin flipping. He has a terrible haircut, and he likes to shoot things using a air gun type device. Well, dude,
you act like I don't watch movies, man.
Okay, all right.
you gave me way too. You're like a trailer. I don't remember his name, but that's Javier Bardem from No Country for Old Men.
Anton Chigurh. Yes, indeed. Right, indeed. Right. This villain, this is one of the most coldest performances I have ever seen in my humble years on this planet. We always say, and there's another villain that I didn't mention, but we've all often talked about Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker and how it's one note and there's really not anything to it. And I've often argued, he's playing one note, but if that one note he's playing is perfect, then I think it's a good performance. This is the same thing here with Javier Bardem. He plays one note during the entire film. And he plays that note that note perfectly. Every time he's on screen, you know some shit's about to go down. He doesn't let anybody stand in his way. He's another one of those unredeemable, you know, people. He doesn't have a redeeming quality in him. He's pure evil. He will kill anything and anybody that stands in his way. And I gotta tell you too, the scene in the gas station where he's taunting that old man about flipping the coin and all that. That is one of the most, I'm sorry, that's probably one of the best, just not only written, but acted scenes in recent years. Probably the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years. It is just so perfectly played. It's a case where both parties know what the other one is saying, but they're not saying it, but they're saying it, if that makes sense in a rambling kind of way. And I know you know the scene I'm talking about, right?
Oh yeah,
the call.
Well, I it's in a gas station, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you this. How do I put this? I'm not one that likes to go see scary movies. Okay, I don't like that. I don't like that visceral where the guy jumps out and you get that electric spark or cold, your blood free. I don't like that feeling.
Right.
Okay. So whenever I'm in a scary movie that I like a scary movie that's a classic that I feel like I have to go see because it's just a good movie, I will turn bitch mode and I will try to sit in the theater with my hands kind of covering my eyes and my thumb in my ears and no one will notice that I'm with bitch mode. During that scene, that's how I watched that scene. That's how intense that scene was because I had no idea what was going to happen. I thought at any moment it was going to be some Kill Bill shit up in there. Heads were going to roll. The fact that that scene had that effect, I mean, all it is was two people talking, speaks highly of Javier Bardem's performance in just a scene of dialogue that was as scary as anything I've seen in any horror or monster movie.
And then what caps that scene off, and I don't know if you remember or not, that little look he gives the guy when he says, "Don't put it in your pocket. That's your lucky coin." And he gives him like a look, like a little, almost a smile, but you know, it's like you do know you just, you know, escaped me, right? He just kind of gives him that look, and I think that again, that's just a perfect coda to that scene. It gives it a little, you know, because even he makes the gas station attendant makes a little sigh of relief, and I think the audience does at the same time, because as you said, it could have gone all either way, and I think he basically didn't want to kill him because maybe I think it was broad daylight, but he easily could have, you know what I mean, and it wouldn't have made a difference to him one way or the other.
Now you have to remind me, what was the reason that Shigeru would have even killed him? I can't remember the setup.
Because the guy kept asking him questions about where he's from. He says, you know, he recognizes plates, and his plates are from out of state. And he goes, you know, what are you doing around here? So the guy was just, but he was just being folksy, you know, and he realized, you know, this guy's asking me too many questions. And that would almost be like if someone came asking, he would remember him. So at that point, he's like,
"Oh, right,
yeah, you know what? This guy's getting too much into my business." But again, he wasn't trying to be nosy. He was just, you know, being, you know, folksy. I mean, there's just so many little brilliant lines in that scene. He says, "You know, what time do you close? Later. Later's not a time. What time do you close?" And he's so just, and he's eating sunflower seeds, and He just looks at him, and this is something else, another line I use in my everyday life. He just kind of looks at him and sighs. He goes, "You have no idea what you're talking about, do you?" I mean, he's like disgusted with this guy. He's like, "Oh, I got to kill this guy. I didn't want to. It's going to mess up my plan." But yeah, Anton. And you know what's also brilliant about that movie, I don't know if you know, that the three lead characters, Tommy Lee Jones, Josh Brolin, and them, they have no screen time together whatsoever. None. They are never on the screen together at the same time. Took me like two or three viewings to actually catch that, which was kind of odd because I usually catch that kind of stuff.
Well, I guess, listen, this is your list, but I'm trying to rationalize why you would put him on your top three, because like you say, he had one performance. I mean, he's not really what's the word I'm looking for? He doesn't live on in perpetuity. And, you know, the movie was just okay. I thought it won the Oscar, I think, that year.
I think it won Best Picture, if memory serves. Kind of a spoiler, but it's on my top 10 list of the greatest movies of all time. It's like number six.
Wow.
Yeah. That's how much I like the
movie. Wow.
That's another show. Whenever the time serves, watch it again. Just watch the performances. Don't particularly worry about the story, because I mean there's a good story in there too, but just watch the performances. All three leads are just exceptional. And
isn't Woody Harrelson's in that, right?
Yeah, Woody Harrelson's in it. Yeah,
he plays a cop, I think.
I think he's like a FBI, or he's something, that and he has a badge, but I forget what type of character it is. Now you're really into cinematography too, and I think that's another aspect of it that you would really appreciate. The way they shoot that openness, that space, because Josh is a hunter or something like that, like a rancher. But just the way they shoot those planes is just brilliant, and I think you would even appreciate that as well.
I got to tell you, I saw the film and I remember very little about it. I remember that scene that you just mentioned, and I also remember there was one kind of suspenseful scene where Josh Brolin rents a room
that
next door to another room, and he's got a bag of money or something with him.
Yeah, yeah. That scene should be that should be studied. That's I often talk about scenes that should be studied, and that's one of them, because the way the Coen brothers use silence in that scene makes it even more terrifying. They could have put some music in there. They could have, you know, pumped up the effects, but what they do is they give you the ambient sound of you hear the footsteps, Shigar's footsteps, coming towards the room. And what makes it even more terrifying is that at the same time, Josh Brolin is calling the front desk, and you hear the phone ringing, and no one's picking up. So he knows I'm in trouble. And again, it's just that sound. Yeah, yeah. Watch it again. I think you may get a greater appreciation for it. Look at the performances and look at the cinematography.
Well, you mentioned the Coen brothers, and that makes me think of another villain that in a film of theirs is probably one of my top 10. And that would be, I think his name is Fred Muntz. Is that, you know that name?
It's ringing a bell.
From Barton Fink. Played by John Goodman. You talk about sound. Have you seen that film?
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
There's a hallway scene in that movie where I believe it's all metaphorical, but the flames start shooting through down the hallway as John Goodman is running towards Barton Fink. But okay, anyway, I digress.
I'll add that to my queue. What is your number two?
Okay, my number two. He would have been number one. You want to guess at it?
Yeah, go ahead. Give me some hints.
Okay, I'll give you. Well, I can't give you too many.
All right.
He would have been number one, except but for the fact that his backstory was ruined.
Darth Vader.
Well, yeah. You said that like you really figured it out.
Well,
that wasn't too hard.
Well, here's the deal. Before you get into your spiel, here's the deal. He's not on my list, and you just said why he's not on my list. The wussification of Darth Vader in the prequels totally ruins the character for the original trilogy, in my humble opinion. I just can't put Darth Vader on my list now because of that.
Well, listen, I understand. I can't imagine you throwing shade to him because of those prequels, because he is one of the greatest villains of all time, and because of that, those prequels don't exist in canon to me.
I humbly believe that as well.
But I don't know if I have to go into detail as to why Darth Vader is on my list. I mean, number one, when you first saw him on screen, your head was blown open.
Yeah, you'd never seen anything like that before.
Okay. This guy comes in all black with some kind of mask. You're like, what the hell is that? And as the movies progress, you learn so much about him. The character is just, even though George Lucas wrote the first one and directed the first one, he did wondrous things with that character. That character made the whole story work because he was just the embodiment of the classic good versus evil.
Yep.
And also, he delivers one of probably the most iconic lines of dialogue in pop history, that being "I am your father."
I'm your father. Yep.
Which was just mimicked on to this day. It was mimicked by the guy who played Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill, in a recent Flash episode.
Yeah.
And I could hear all the collective geeks' heads explode when, and I knew Mark Hamill was going to say that to this young kid on the Flash. I'm not going to get into the Flash episode, but he delivers that line, and it was just like pudding. Empire Strikes Back is one of my all-time top 10 favorite movies, and Darth Vader is at his baddest in that film.
Yes, he was.
Because the Empire wins. He starts to get a little wussy in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say that the ending where he turns away from the dark side was a load of crock of shit, that he would never turn. But I loved it. I mean, it's a complete arc from where we saw him at the beginning to where we go to in Return of the Jedi. He redeems himself. And from then on, there's no other Darth Vader. There's no Anakin Skywalker.
You know, and
because go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and I think we got into this on the show. Which I guess not hologram, but which spirit do you believe in? The Sebastian Shaw spirit or the Hayden Christensen spirit at the end of Jedi? Which do you think should be there?
That's an interesting question. I'm going to say I understand why Lucas did what he did.
I agree. Yeah, I understand it.
Because if you come to those prequels not knowing you're younger, if you're under the age of 20, you won't know who, I can't even, what's his name, Sebastian?
Yeah, Sebastian Shaw.
Sebastian Shaw.
Yeah.
You'll look at that and say, who the hell is that? Right? If you look at him. Well, actually, no, you won't. Because
you would, because we see his face.
Yeah, you do. So, yeah, fuck that. Yeah.
It's the other way around.
Yeah, Sebastian Shaw. Yeah, he should be there.
Well, see, I was going to say, Lucas's theory is that...
I know what you're going
to say. Anakin died as Hayden Christian, so that's what the spirit should be. But I'm like, well, no, because we see Sebastian Shaw talking... And, you know, without the mask, we see, yeah, he's very much alive.
See, when you said he died, I thought you meant metaphorically. He died.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, I meant metaphorically, but we still see, you know, if we had never seen his face, maybe you could buy it, but.
Well, no. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was done. I mean, you could buy it, but no. with a seeing his face, I don't think it works as well.
See, what I'm saying is, some people have made the argument, I've heard this argument, and it's a logical argument, it makes sense, that the reason you see Hayden Christensen is because that was before he turned to the dark side, he was Hayden Christensen. He was Anakin.
Yeah, right, Anakin, right? Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that you see him alive as Darth Vader in that Zen philosophical sense. However, I would say that since he went back to good before he died in Return of the Jedi, that's an argument that you would still see his spirit as Sebastian Shaw.
Right, yeah. I mean, either way. And then how did he put on all that weight?
Well, I mean, we got another film coming out in December, and Mark Hamill, unless he's been hitting the gym.
Well, I mean, but, you know, he's in a... Darth Vader's in the suit, so you got to figure the suit's hot, right? You know, sweat.
The suit. Oh, come on, man.
That's what I mean. How did Hayden Christensen become Sebastian Shaw in that suit?
Well, I'm sure they got a. I'm sure they got a Sith Mo Ginsburg that can do alterations. What do you?
They got a Whataburger and Tatooine.
Yeah, you know that is I can forgive that.
Nah, I know. All right. So the grand finale, the best villain, in my humble opinion, and you've actually already mentioned him in your honorable mentions. So let's see if I can give. He has the best beard out of all the villains on the list.
Okay.
He has an affinity for suits, particularly. Yep. German suits.
Well,
you know who it is.
And he also says motherfucker a lot.
Yes, he does. Well, he only says it, and he messes it up, though.
And he can't fly.
Well.
Yes, that would be Hans Gruber.
That would be Hans Gruber, Die Hard, which is, in my opinion, the best action movie probably in the last 30, 40 years, but that's probably another show. Die Hard to me is, I don't know, it's like the template. I would say a vast majority of action films since Die Hard have tried to copy it, even the sequels, which, you know, I 2 is hit and miss, 3 I really don't like all that much, 4 is okay, and then
stop. 4 is absolutely ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, but it's in spirit of the film, of the series, I think. You know, McClane, surfing on a wing, yeah, that's a bit much. And, you know, him out racing the fighters while they're shooting him driving a big semi-truck, yeah, it's unbelievable. But if it's well done, I mean, you know, hey, it's a movie. Everything's made up. Nothing's real. You know, you don't believe the Death Star is actually floating around in space.
But the thing is that in the first two Die Hards, well, it made to the third one to a certain degree, you felt like he was still a human being that could get hurt.
Yeah.
And in Die Hard 4, he's surviving falling through concrete, jumping off a wing of a plane into onto the ground, and then the next one after that was even more stupid.
A Good Day to Die Hard is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I mean, I you know, we go from one of the best movies ever made to one of the worst movies ever made in the span of a couple of years. But anyway, let's get back to Hans. Hans is the coolest villain of all. He is what you want villains to be. And at that time, he was actually what's the word I'm looking for? He was against type. Because at that point, all the villains were Middle Eastern. They were sweaty. They had really, really, you know, crazy accents, although he has one too. But they were typically always, you know, again, of Middle Eastern descent. They were usually – so here comes a guy that walks in. He's slick. He's got the nice suit. I mean, he could pass for someone who works in the building, which he actually does at one point. But at the same time, as cool as he is, he's just as calculating and cold. You know, don't let that suit fool you. I mean, he is a bad man. But again, we're talking about performances, which I think he should have gotten a nomination for Best Supporting Actor, but that's a different story. He exudes so much coolness that you actually do start to really like him. Not in the sense of, oh, I want to hang out with him, but you know, he's giving a good performance. And by liking the villain, that makes what Bruce Willis is doing even more important for him to fail him or beat him because of that. Anything on it?
Well, see, you said he was you hinted at him being the first of his kind in terms of villains. And see, I would say that he was ripped from the DNA of Victor Maitland from Beverly Hills Cop.
I mean, that guy,
well, let's run it down. He was very cool, suave, wore suits everywhere he went, was an art curator, very, very cultured. And I think he's more refined than Hans Gruber is. Because Victor never got his hands dirty. You know?
Yeah.
I'm just making an argument that I think Victor set the template.
I think if we would have gotten to spend a little bit more time with Victor, and of course that was never going to happen because that, you know, it was an Eddie Murphy movie. But I think given the length, I guess, of Die Hard, it was they were able to give Hans a lot more screen time, and I think his motives were kind of shady and unclear, and then at the end we find out what his motives actually were. But I could see that, but I still think that I just think that Hans kind of set the new standard. Maybe Beverly Hills Cop started it, but Die Hard took it and ran with it, and because most people don't remember Victor Maitland when they think about Die Hard, they think Eddie Murphy. I mean, I think Hans Gruber is synonymous with Die Hard, just like John McClane.
Well, you know, since we're talking about Die Hard, I have to be honest with you. I liked Die Hard, but I enjoyed Die Hard 2. And I know I'm probably in the minority in that, but Die Hard 2 also featured, again, Robert Patrick from The Terminator.
Yep.
But I liked Die Hard 2 because it... I mean, the whole... Die Hard was unique in that it all took place in one location for the most part.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case with Die Hard 2, and I think a lot of critics of Die Hard 2 point to that as why it wasn't as good as Die Hard, but I think I liked it because it was more expansive.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. It was bigger than Die Hard, and I definitely don't want to go off too much on a tangent, but at some point I am going to talk about how Die Hard would not have been what it was if it wasn't for Bruce Willis. Now, Hans also, you know, that characterization also lifted it up. But I often tell people, you have to remember or know the genesis of what Bruce Willis was doing at that time. I mean, we know him now as this big, mega, you know, action star. But he was still a moonlighting when, you know, and he was this, you know, goofy, always singing, always cracking jokes. You know, he was that character. And to a certain extent, John McClane is just really just a more of a foul-mouthed David Addison. And and I think that baggage, and I'm using the word baggage, but I mean that in a good way, being able to bring that persona to that film helps that film even more. I mean, it's still a good film if you don't know Bruce Willis or remember Bruce Willis from Moonlighting, but I think that that's another aspect of it that's underlying that helps it. And you had said, too, you mentioned human. We hadn't seen a character like John McClane in an action movie. You know, Arnold, you know, Stallone, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Steven Seagal. And I think what sets that film, what sets Die Hard apart from most action films is the scene where he's in the bathroom and he's, you know, got the tears in his eyes and he's, you know, tell my wife I love her and, you know, she's heard me say I'm sorry a million times. Oh, no, she's heard me say I love you a million times, but she's never heard me say I'm sorry. That scene, to me, is Die Hard, and that scene is what pushes it and elevates it to classic status, because we hadn't seen that. We hadn't seen that vulnerability at all in an action hero. I mean, and he thought he was going to die, and then we, the audience, they hit. I mean, this guy could die. How could he, you know, survive all this? And, you know, it's just a great, great film, and again, great performances all the way around.
Now I got a couple questions for you. You talking about, you know, this is the first time we'd seen a vulnerable hero, and it's the first time we would never have thought in 1988 that Bruce Willis. I vaguely remember seeing, you know, trailers, or they weren't so much. Yeah, there were trailers then, but I remember thinking Bruce Willis.
Everybody was thinking Bruce Willis, and
but now, do you think? Well, let me just ask this. Do you feel that that's, since he went from a comic type of environment to this, do you think that paved the way for executives saying, yeah, Michael Keaton can play a superhero?
Yeah, I think so.
And do you think that, do you think it affected Arnold's career? Because I want to say after Die Hard, you saw Arnold go from playing like Commandos and Terminators and Conans to playing like what the character he played in what was that movie he played where he was a clown? The Fifth Day, I think it was.
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of the title.
He's a family man all of a sudden, and then you have him playing in True Lies where he's married and he's married to Jamie Lee Curtis. He do you think that's why he went that direction?
Yeah, I think so, because we've talked about this ad nauseum too. Hollywood is reactionary, right? So they see this film make all this money. They took a chance on a guy who had no history in action, and it was, you know, Die Hard was funny. It's as funny as it is exciting. And I think that was things that were missing from the Schwarzenegger films, the Van Dammes, all that. They were all gritty. This was more light. So I think, yeah. So Hollywood at that point says, yes, let's interject some humor into these films. I mean, even Bruce Willis, his persona totally changed. Again, he was if you look at his first three films, Blind. That's what kind of paved the way for, and that's why I say it's still influencing. How many movies or how many films can you say
Oh, yeah. You think so, huh? Well, from what I remember of it, but it stars Steven Seagal, who's not the best thespian in the world. Is that the one where the little girl from E.T. jumps out of from E.T. jumps out of the
Barrymore?
I didn't know. It's not Drew Barrymore. It's the girl from E.T. who is in the school scene with Elliot.
Erica.
Eleniac. Yeah. I like that part.
Obviously. But Undersea is good. But now I tell you, one of the honor that's very underrated is, and I'll probably make it. Yeah, you remember that one? That was Die Hard at the hockey game with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
I don't really go to see Jean-Claude Van Damme. I saw Time Cop. That's about it. Well, I'm a little prejudicial here because I've seen this film so many times. I don't know if it's my favorite film of all time anymore, but I remember when I sat down, I remember I came home from college. I was on a break, and I just happened to be sitting down, flick through channels, and this movie came on. I said, oh, let me sit and watch this. I've heard about this. I was mesmerized. This movie took me on a roller coaster ride. There's one series of scenes in this film towards the end that is just still to this day gets my blood racing. So the person who is the villain in this film, I'll give you three clues. The first clue is he plays with bulls and bears. Okay. All right. He lives in New York. He had the biggest cell phone in the history of cinema. Okay. This is another character who I should be able to quote all his lines, but they're so well written, I won't be able to quote them. I'll be able to paraphrase them. But the line that this guy is most famously known for, and the line that was quoted throughout the 80s, and the line that was, again, called back to in a movie with Ben Affleck, this is my man, Gordon Gekko. I do not want to say that he's the best villain of all time, but for me, I will never forget the experience I had when I sat down on that summer break and watched this film directed by Oliver Stone. At that moment, Oliver Stone became, he supplanted Spielberg for me. That film is, you know, I'm going to say it's probably still is my favorite film of all time. Gordon Gekko is such a classic villain because he embodies a whole era of American culture. He is the 80s. He is the me decade. The look that he portrays, the slick back hair, the suspenders, the classic 80s, you know, the pinstripe shirt with the white collar, the line "greed is good." That line is still quoted today. The way Michael Douglas plays him, I mean, I wish I could quote lines like I did with Zod, but his lines are so intricate. But there's one line that he said. I alluded to a sequence. You've seen the film, right? Okay. There's a scene where I'm going to spoil this because the movie came out in 1980, and they ruined this character in Money Never Sleeps, the sequel. But there's a sequence where Bud Fox, played by Charlie Sheen, brings his father's business to the table for the purpose of Gordon to invest in the company. Okay. And I should say that Charlie Sheen's dad is played by his real dad, Martin Sheen. And this was before Charlie Sheen lost all of his marbles. Okay. Right. Well, he got the job done. I mean, he was good in Platoon. I've always said I would love to go back in a time machine into Hollywood and say, and cast Tom Cruise in all of his films to see how they would have turned out. Because they were kind of the same type of, but Tom Cruise was a better actor, I think. But there's a sequence of events where James Spader takes Charlie Sheen into the boardroom of his law firm's company. And Charlie Sheen learns that Gordon Gekko is preparing to break up Blue Star. It's an airline, and sell off all the assets, and all of the people that Charlie Sheen promised his father would have jobs for the rest of their lives will be out of work. So the sequence of Charlie Sheen becoming the student and turning into the teacher and pulling the rug out from under Gordon Gekko was one of the most brilliant montages to me still in cinematic history. But there's a scene where Gordon Gekko is starting to panic because Blue Star is getting bought up quicker than Gordon Gekko can account for, because he wanted to corner the market on those shares. And he says to his partner, you know, if I find out who leaked this, I'm gonna come down. I'm gonna rip their eyes out of the fucking skull. I can't remember what he says, but it's so brilliant. I'm not doing it justice because, I mean, he's so well played by Michael Douglas, and every line he says oozes with evil. I believe he did. And you know what's odd about that? I think I saw this on either the special features of the DVD Blu-ray. If I'm not mistaken, they talk about how Michael Douglas was nervous, or he was a little not feeling very confident about taking the role. And there's a scene where it's told that Oliver Stone entered Michael Douglas's trailer and basically cursed him out and said, "What the fuck are you doing? Why are you ruining my movie?" And Michael's like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "You're acting as shit." He said, Michael Douglas says, "He came into my trailer and basically read me the riot act for being a bad actor." And Michael Douglas's response was he was going to give him 200%. Now, I don't know if that's if that was Oliver's being a director and kicking his actor in the ass and using hyperbole, but man, did it work. Well, I just think it's a brilliant performance, and he is a villain that I kind of cheer for.
Yeah.
Because he's just so slick with it.
Yeah, and that's the phrase that I would use for my number two is Hans. You know, you kind of cheer for him, but you know he's the bad guy. And, you know, I don't know if it was Alan Rickman who said this, but some famous actor was asked how they approach playing villains. And I'm pretty sure this was Alan Rickman. We could probably Google and find out. But he said, you know, I'm pretty sure it was Hans. Anyway, he says, I didn't play Hans as a villain. I played him as the hero. McClane is the villain. And if you think about that, most villains per se, they don't know that they're the villain. You know what I mean? They don't think they're going to lose in other words. I mean, you know, when Hans, you know, walked into the building, he didn't know it was going to end with him, you know, falling stories to his death. You know what I mean? I mean, he, you know, figured it was foolproof. He had his plan. That was, there are some flaws in it, but that's a different story. But I just found that was interesting that was the approach that he took, that he was the hero of the movie, not McClane, and that's how he played it.
Yeah, well, no doubt. I was going to make the statement that if you remember Wall Street, there's another actor in that film who was also on our list, and it was the second it was the second time I'd seen him, and he was just as genius in this film, and that would be Terrence Stamp.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
He plays Sir Lawrence Wildman, who is the other corporate raider who helps to supplant Gordon Gekko, that Charlie Sheen, Bud Fox teams up with. But I remember the line. He says, "If I find out who leaked this, I'm gonna come down there and rip their eyeballs out and suck their fucking skulls." Now, the other legend about this film is that two things. That what's the actress who is? She was the '80s version of Katherine Heigl. Sean Young. She was hated on the set. No one liked her.
I don't think she's ever been liked on any movie that she's been in. But
Oliver Stone regretted casting her. That was the one thing about that. And then the other one was that Daryl Hannah. She was kind of disliked on the set too, because no one thought she was convincing. She was like the Sofia Coppola of the cast. But I thought she did a serviceable job. I thought she did pretty good. But I absolutely love this movie. Gordon Gekko is the man, and the only thing that kills me is how they wasted that character and made him toothless in Wall Street Money Never Sleeps.
Well, we know that was a cash grab, so I don't even... I've never even bothered to watch it. It just seems like that was a movie that was only inspired by the checkbook and not by, you know, creativity. Now I do want to kind of pick your brain here. There were a couple of names that I thought I might hear, but and maybe it's too soon, so to speak. Possibly absent, and I had actually considered them, but I'm actually watching the film again this weekend. He's missing an arm.
Wait, say what I'm saying. Oh, are we talking about Winter Soldier?
Gee, you think? Yes.
Well,
maybe it's too soon.
You know,
maybe
what?
It's too soon. I don't know.
I think, you know, here's the thing. When I chose my villains, I tried to choose villains for... this was my criteria. Do people still reference them today in any way, shape, or form?
Right. Well, that's what I mean. Is it too soon to...
But also... Is it a villain that you've seen in plenty? I mean, all villains are from the same genotype. We know that. But is it a villain? See, the Winter Soldier, he was a great villain, but he's no different from so many other villains that you see.
But I will say he has probably one of the best entrances of...
That's true.
Of probably, well, with the exception maybe of Darth Vader. Or Heath Ledger as the Joker. He's got an entrance, and then Loki.
Okay.
Since I'm in full, you know, Marvel cinematic world right now. Loki is, but again, is it too soon? You know, for us to be having that discussion, him being on the all time, because I think my most current is. Anton Sugar, and that was, I think that film was 2005, 2006. I mean, again, I don't, you know, he's not one that people, you know, he's not a household name like a Darth Vader, like a Zod, like a Hans or a Khan, but, you know, I think he, you know, is enough impression, but I don't know, maybe it's too soon for Loki.
No, I think Loki's a good choice. I wouldn't say it's too soon for him because he's unique. I would say he's unique. I would say Winter Soldier, much as I love that film, and as much as he is a badass, there's not much to him. He doesn't have much dialogue, so I only get one level.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, I'm trying to think who else there was in that film. I would say, you could consider putting on your list, even though the movie just came out, what, last year or was it a couple years ago? But last year, right?
Winter Soldier?
Yeah.
Yeah, last year.
I would say you could consider Alexander Pierce.
Yeah. Redford?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one scene where he shoots the maid,
mm-hmm.
he entered the villain. he deserved to be bandied about in the villain Hall of Fame, right, because of that.
That is true. And then we forgot one, we should both hand it on ours right now. How can we forget the villainy, the vile, the
all right, well, hold, give me, let me guess, give me some clues here.
He's in a band.
Oh my God, yeah, come on, how, yeah, you're right, you're right.
How can we forget Morris Day?
Oh, dude, now wait, hold up. Was that a bit of redirection?
no redirection at all. I thought you
were going to say J.K. Simmons from Whiplash.
No, I don't think he's a villain per se, but no.
What?
I don't think he's a villain. I think you know, crime and that kind of thing. But you know, I guess he is the antagonist. I don't think he's the villain per se. But no, I'm just making a joke about Morris Day. I mean, you know.
Oh,
but
okay.
I guess he was the villain in Purple Rain, though.
Yeah. Well, you yourself said villain. You think of crime.
Yeah,
and...
yeah. He was the antagonist in Purple Rain.
Right. But now I'm gonna throw another name out at you that is very recent. So recent. I mean, we're talking about recent within the last month.
I know. I already know.
And this guy, I kind of saw it when they announced that he was going to be playing this comic book character.
Fisk.
Vincent D'Onofrio. Yes. I mean, all of his roles, I think I'm going to say I saw him in, I want to say he was in Mystic Pizza.
I believe he
was in Men in Black.
Yep.
And he played in... Full Metal Jacket.
That was his film debut.
Right. And there was a TV show. He played one of the, not CSI,
Law
but one Order. Of the Law and Order.
Criminal Intent.
Right. I think he's found the role that's going to define him for the rest of his career.
I will agree with that, although I'm only on episode 5 or 6. But I got to say, I think I mentioned on the earlier show, I still kind of stand by the statement that I enjoy watching Gotham more just because it's got more stuff going on, more humor, and it's lighter. But when I got to the end, and I know we're going to do a review at some point, but when I got to the end of episode 4, I even looked at my wife because she's in the show more than I am. But I looked at her and I said, I'm all in now. I am all in.
I can't remember what happened. What specifically happened?
The car door. That's all I'll say.
Oh,
I was all in after that. I don't care. I don't care if the rest of the episode sucked. That scene that was worth sitting through the other 3 episodes just to see that moment.
Now, didn't I tell you to stop bitching until you see until you see him on screen?
Yeah, you know, I wish they would have introduced him a bit earlier because I would have probably gotten into it more, but you know, sooner. But no, I am 100% all in now. That was the most, one of the most vile, just brutal things I have ever seen on television. And I mean, I know it's not on television per se, but yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Wilson Fisk went ISIS.
Pretty much. And so, just to kind of dovetail, and then we'll wrap up. As you know, and as you've given me shit for, I've been delving, like I said, delving back into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Is this gonna be Thor?
Yes, you're reading my mind.
Lord help us.
Well, you're gonna actually like what I'm about to say. So. We watched Iron Man 3 because I know that's the first film in Phase 2. My wife jokingly called it Ironless Man, but I thought that was kind of.
Your wife is very what's the word? Insightful.
I thought that was very funny. We were both underwhelmed by it. It had its moments, but we were like, eh. And then what was next? Thor: The Dark World. Right? Yeah, that's the one. And I I sat there and I'm looking at her because she had watched the first one the day before. And I'm watching this thing, and okay. I'm going, this is terrible. And I'm like, this is worse than I remembered it, right? And I was like, what did I give it? I don't remember saying it was awful, right? So I go and I go to my blog, I pull up my review, and I gave it 2 stars. I'm like, I gave this 2 stars? Why? I was like, was I on the Marvel payroll and I missed the check? You know? That would be what I would definitely retract. I'd probably get that like a half a star if I had to write that review again. I don't know what I was thinking, giving that 2 stars.
Well, I downloaded it, and I plan to watch it again just to see if I could have been very wrong when I went to the theater. But if you recall in our review, this is one of those films where I very rarely walk out on films. I walked out on 15 Minutes. If you remember that film with Edward Burns and De Niro and Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah.
I walked out on Sling Blade. Now, I'm not going to say it was a bad film, but it just didn't hold me and I had some place to be.
Right. Okay. All right.
But Thor: The Dark World, I just recall there was a point. I think it was after it wanted to be Star Wars.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm thirsty. It was when they arrive on the dark planet or something, and somebody gets their hand cut off. I can't remember.
Yeah, you know, I trust me. I saw it just on Sunday or Saturday or whatever. I don't even remember it. So,
and I went out to the concession stand. It was a long walk too because we were in the back. We were in the back theater of the multiplex, and it was easily a 10-minute wait to get popcorn and something to drink. And I was like, eh. And when I came back,
they were still enough, there.
They were still on that planet talking.
Yeah, I got Winter Soldier in the mail today from Netflix, so that's going to be next up on the chopping block. But all right, so we've given our villains and definitely give ours. So or give your guys, put it on the site. Let us know who your favorite villains are, and if you have disagreements with us, we'd love to hear that too and do a little verbal sparring.
I mean, have we left any villains out, though? I can't think of anyone we left
out.
Well,
I mean, I think, you mentioned Norman Bates. I mean, there's. I mean, you could maybe mention Max Cady from Cape Fear.
I don't.
I mean, you know, it's a one-off.
But, now, you're talking about De Niro or Mitchum?
I'm talking about De Niro, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure there's. I mean, you could argue Scarface. I mean, you know, Tony Montana. You could argue he's.
Now that's villain. But that's interesting, because he's the protagonist of that story. So who would be the villain in that story?
Himself. I think he's protagonist and antagonist, because at the end he's his own worst enemy. So he basically is the reason why he is dead.
So. I guess you know, I could think of maybe the devil. In The Exorcist as a great villain. And
that would be the ultimate villain.
And the entity in the paranormal films.
Paranormal Activity?
Yes. That was tongue in cheek right there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, what's funny about those is I like the first two, but they've gotten so ridiculous now that I have now in place a ban on all found footage film. Hill Street Views will not be reviewing any movie that is a found footage movie.
Okay. And and with that narrow-minded view, which I'm not saying I don't wholly disagree with, we're going to wrap it up. Please go to the site, podcastjuice.net. Let us know what you think, and we will see you in the aisle rather soon. Later.
Peace.